Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is a visitor to Chapel Hill, Etap Room. As some of you who know me know how excited I've been about her new book, a debut novel called A Woman Is No Man. I want to talk to her about her new book and about her life in the Brooklyn Palestinian immigrant community, and also how her move to North Carolina has impacted all of these things, why she came to North Carolina to write her first book. Well, Etap Room, welcome to Chapel Hill.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Now, you're a North Carolinian now. You're not a Brooklynite anymore, right?
I guess. I guess we can say that, yes.
Well, I want to talk to you about, let's talk about the book first, and then can we come back and talk about how you happen to come. Tell us what you will about your new book, A Woman Is No Man.
So my debut novel, A Woman Is No Man, follows three generations of Palestinian American women. Ezra, who is a newlywed that immigrates to America from Palestine, her daughter, Daya, the eldest of four, as well as Ezra's mother-in-law, Farida, who is a also an immigrant to America and who has grown up in the refugee camps post-1948 exodus. And so we follow this three-generational story, and we learn about the ways in which they live their lives in the strictures of their community.
Well, what is the basic thread of the story? You told us about a little bit about the characters, and what is there a story here, or is it just a examination of these folks' character?
It is both. It's a plot-driven novel, but the base of it is this newlywed 17-year-old Ezra who gets into an arranged marriage and moves to America, hoping that she will have a better life than the life of her mother in Palestine, hoping that America will allow her the freedom to do what she has aspired to do, read, perhaps get an education, only to find those hopes and dreams snatched away from her. And then she gives birth to these daughters, and one of them is Daya. And along the course of the novel, Ezra dies, and Daya then is left to carry on the narrative and to try to break free from the chains of misogyny and patriarchy in which her family is being held by, and to try to break free from the past and forge a new life for herself, unlike her mother's.
Great. Well, I loved the description of life in Palestine in the early part of the book. It was kind of a shocker for me. So tell us about the mother in Palestine and the and her life and her husband, the father, in Palestine, mm-hmm. of your heroine.
So Ezra's mother and father are 100% Palestinian, and they are living a very simple life. They're not, they've been evacuated from their homes years ago, and so now they are living in a small town in Birzeit, very humble, very humble life. They're poor. They just want their kids to get married, the daughters to get married, and the sons to maintain their family's business, and that's their life is just a very simple cultural life. And the suitor comes from America who wants to marry their daughter. And to these very poor folks, this is an opportunity to send their daughter to America, to give her a better life, perhaps to come to America one day too. You know,
that they may be able to follow.
They may be able to follow her. So they see this as an opportunity for their daughter. And 17-year-old Ezra, not knowing any better, of course, hopes that this is also an opportunity for her to get a better life and to shy or to move away from the confinements of her culture and her society in Palestine.
Well, I think what struck me and what I'd love for you to talk about is how unpleasant life is for women, for married women, and for daughters in Palestine. And can you elaborate on that a little bit, as you do in the book?
Yeah, absolutely. So for this family, so again, I would love to take this opportunity to remind everyone that this is not I'm not an expert on all families in Palestine or all women in Palestine, but this is a family story about a very particular family that treats their women with the assumption that marriage and motherhood are at the prime importance of their life, that that is what they should aspire to and nothing beyond that. And many other cultures, of course, can relate to this. This is not a very particular, oh, only women in Palestine are raised to think that marriage and motherhood are should be at the center of their world. Of course not. But I do want to clarify that that is not every single Palestinian woman can agree with that. But the people in my novel, the women at my novel, yes, they are raised to believe that they are supposed to get married. They're supposed to bear children, sons, to carry on the family name, not daughters, because daughters are a source of shame in the community, a source of a burden, you know, having to raise a daughter and make sure that she doesn't get corrupted, she doesn't lose her virginity, she doesn't ruin the family honor. And so there's this sense that women are unworthy and shameful things, and that we must, if we bring them into the world, we must marry them off quickly and pass on this burden to another man and focus on our sons who are going to take care of us when we get old and carry on this family name. So I felt like that was the reality of my life growing up as a daughter of Palestinian immigrants. Even though I was born and raised in Brooklyn, I still had to experience many of these cultural, this passing down of culture and values and the ways in which women are devalued and the ways in which men are not. And that's why I wanted to write about it.
Well, I'm glad you did. Tell us a little bit about this marriage that took place in Palestine, and then the trip of the mom, the newlywed, to America and to Brooklyn, and what she saw when she got there.
So she marries Adam, who lives in New York, lives in Brooklyn, runs a deli, and moves to Palestine to get married and bring his wife back to America. So she marries Adam, and when she first lands in Brooklyn, all she sees are skyscrapers of Manhattan, and she is thinking to herself, now Ezra loves to read, so she's an avid reader, but she thinks to herself when the plane is landing in JFK in New York, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. I don't think I could have ever imagined this view, even if I'd read 1,000 books. So she's instantly filled with the sense of hope that life will be better and that she will see all these beautiful things and get to experience a life that she never would have experienced had she never left Palestine, and that her destiny as a woman will finally be better than her mother's destiny. And of course, you know, as we follow her story, we see that that is no different, that she's still confined by her culture.
Wow, that's incredible. What does she find in Brooklyn? If I would go to Brooklyn, I would think this is a great place, a lot of bars, a lot of places to party, a lot of opportunities to meet new people and expand my interest. How did she relate to Brooklyn that she was the Brooklyn where she lived?
So the Brooklyn where she lived is 1990s. Early 1990s is when she arrives, and she sees Manhattan and she thinks this glorious city. And then all of a sudden she, you know, gets on in a cab. She hails from Queens to Brooklyn to Bay Ridge, Fifth Avenue, this very small, graffitied neighborhood. And she thinks to herself, this dull neighborhood with houses that are crammed, you know, row houses side by side, look nothing like the Manhattan that she saw from the plane. So automatically she's given this sense of, wait a minute, this Brooklyn is much smaller, much more confined. America, the land of the free, all of a sudden doesn't seem as free setting wise because she lives in this house in the basement.
Where does she live?
Lives on Fifth Avenue, 72nd Street.
With whom does she live, I guess?
With her mother-in-law, with Farida.
Her brother-in-law.
Yes,
and
with
it's a crowded house.
Farida's kids. So Farida, Adam's the eldest son. So with Farida, his mother, and his younger siblings, he has their three boys and a girl.
Is there any love relationship that develops with Adam during the course of their marriage?
Well, Ezra tries her best to love Adam in the way she has seen love in her life. So she's seen love only between her parents, and she tries to replicate the love that she saw her mother gave her father, which was a love of subservience and obedience, and she tries to replicate that with Adam, hoping that she could finally win his favor and get him to love her in the way that she's read about in books, the love that she's read about in books. She read 1001 Nights and Rumi, Gibran, Hafiz, all of these poets. And she's thinking to herself, I don't know what love is because I haven't seen it in my life. I've only seen it in this very domesticated way between my mother and father. But perhaps if I love Adam enough, if I please him enough, he'll love me too, and I'll finally get that love that I want.
Now, do they have some children, and how did the children get a reaction from the mother-in-law and the father-in-law?
Yes, so of course Ezra has four daughters. Dea, who is my protagonist, is the eldest daughter.
She becomes the central, she's not the central character at the beginning, but she becomes the central
character. Yeah, well, the story is told from alternating viewpoints, so the story actually opens up with Dea.
Yeah, that's true.
And then Dea tells us, in order to tell you my story, I have to take you back to the beginning, and then she takes us back to her mother. So yes, so Ezra has four daughters, and she's shamed for having them, like I said.
Why would you be ashamed of having four children? It looks like the family, you've blessed the family with these wonderful women who will be the mentors and the folks who take care of the family.
Yeah, Arab culture is hardly the first culture to prefer sons over daughters, but in this specific family, immigrants who have been traumatized by the 1948 Palestinian exodus, have been traumatized by being evacuated from their homes, losing their homelands, being raised in refugee camps, and then being forced out of these refugee camps in search for a better life for America, right? These are these immigrants of the story. They are even more obsessed with having sons because they feel like that's all they have in order to preserve their identity and their family name. If they had daughters, then they would lose their identity because no one would be there to carry their family name. And that is especially important in America, Brooklyn and New York, because they're already outsiders in this place and with nothing else to hold on to. So Ezra is shaming them by not giving them the sons that they need to preserve themselves and their identity.
Well, tell us a little bit about Adam's development as a husband. And you know, there are these things that you deal with about violence in the family. How does that arise in your story?
I wanted to look at trauma and the way it trickles down between generations, and I wanted to focus on the trauma that this Palestinian family has faced in Palestine by being evacuated. It seems political, but it's more psychological, right? So we look at this very political event, the 1948 exodus, and Palestinians being evacuated from their homes. And then we see the trauma of this family, Farida and her husband. And they take this trauma, and then it trickles down across generations. So Farida is getting beat because...
By her husband?
By her husband, which is Adam's father, early in the refugee camps. And Adam grows up and sees this and normalizes it within himself. And so over the course of his marriage with Ezra, he begins to repeat those patterns of abuse. And it's this trickling down of abuse. So that I really wanted to explore how Farida and Khaled have been abused and traumatized in their own way, and how the battering of men contributes to the battering of women, and so on and so forth. So those are things that I wanted to look at when I was writing the novel.
Well, you talk a little bit about the children, but there is one child, one of the daughters, the oldest daughter, becomes a very important character. Tell us about her.
About Dea. Yeah, so Dea is the protagonist of my novel, and she is afraid to repeat her mother's life. And so she is trying to go against what her grandparents want for her, which is, again, marriage, motherhood, that's their path of what it means to be a woman. And she wants to resist that. She wants to go to college. She doesn't want to get into an arranged marriage. And so it's her resistance that kind of drives the plot forward.
Well, how does the conservative mother-in-law react to these aspirations?
Of course, she doesn't want. She wants to maintain her culture.
I should say grandmother. Her grandmother.
The grandmother wants to maintain the culture. Farida does not want Dea to postpone marriage and search for her identity and in search for a career. She doesn't think that that's important. To her, what's important is sheltering her daughters and making sure that they don't get corrupted by American values and making sure they maintain their Arabness.
Well, it's an interesting to me how Daya deals with the outside world. And she breaks out of her Palestinian household a little more strongly than her mother was able to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that she's actually a first-generation Arab American. She was born in Brooklyn. She's an American. Ezra, though she moved to America when she was 17, didn't even know the language. So she wasn't educated. So that, I mean, there's a power play here with education and the power that being an American citizen gives you, the privilege that you have. Like, I'm very privileged because I'm an American citizen. I am doing things with my life that my mother only dreamed of doing. And so I feel like those elements are very important into distinguishing those characters. Despite their limited existence as women, Daya is empowered because of her American her Americanness.
Well, I want to take a quick break and we'll come back. If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Itef Rum, and we're talking about her brand new book, a debut novel, A Woman Is No Man. I'm learning why this book has gotten a lot of attention.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Itef Rum. If you joined us late, we're talking about her debut novel, A Woman Is No Man. She is a North Carolinian. She lives in North Carolina, but she grew up in Brooklyn. And like a Chapel Hill hero Betty Smith, she moved from Brooklyn to North Carolina to write her book about Brooklyn, growing up in Brooklyn. Talk to us, Itef. Welcome again. So glad
Thank
you're
you.
In Chapel Hill.
Thank you.
Betty Smith would be proud of you as a fellow Brooklynite.
That is writing, my honor.
Talk about Daya, who is the third generation, who's a first generation American, but a third generation of the family,
yes.
The Palestinian family that you portray in your book.
Yeah.
And she's sort of liberated, but she's just, but the family responsibilities and the conflict that she has being loyal to her family conflict with her aspirations. How does all this you don't have to give away your book, but how does all this get resolved?
Well, Daya needs to grow as a character, and she uses, what I loved about writing this character is that she knows that she's confined by her traditions and her culture, and she's only 18 years old, so there's so much she can do. But at the same time, she is an avid reader, like her mother, and she uses books as an escape and as an attempt to understand herself and her place in the world. And so she's reading books like A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. She reads Lord of the Flies, all of these novels that help her understand who she is and why her world is the way she is. But she's a little bit frustrated because she can't seem to find her story in these books. The story of a first-generation Arab American. She can't seem to find her voice. And she decides towards the end of the novel that that's what she wants to do. She wants to give voice to women like her, and she wants to be the one that tells her story for the first time. And so we go with her on this journey to find her.
Yeah. Well, talk to us about how this your character grows up. And she's grown up in an Arab, Palestinian, Muslim community. What's it like for her? But she's also surrounded. She goes to school outside of her home. How does all that work?
So she's her parents died. Ezra and Adam die in a mysterious car accident when she's 7 years old, and she and her three younger siblings, the four daughters, are being raised by their grandparents Farida and Khaled, and they attend an all-girls school in Brooklyn. So they don't go to public school because Farida is afraid that public schools will corrupt her granddaughters and will make them lose their values. So she is very sheltered. She goes to school, she comes home, she doesn't really leave the house without her grandparents. And so though she has these aspirations for what she wants to become and who she wants to be, which include going to college and postponing marriage, there's really only so much that she could do. it's only until one day she receives this letter in the mail about someone who wants to tell her a little bit more about her parents and her parents' death that she goes on this journey to find out these family secrets and ultimately gains courage to break free from the cycle.
Well, tell us a little bit about how she grows up. Her mother was, of course, married at 17. Does Daya have any boyfriends, or does she have any prospects for getting married? What are the options that she has?
Well, she doesn't have boyfriends because she's sheltered. And she's sitting with suitors, and her prospects of marriage...
What do you mean, sitting with suitors?
So she's sitting with men that her grandmother is arranging for her to follow the footsteps of her mother with an arranged marriage. So in her family, dating is forbidden. Just like with Ezra, women should remain virgins until they're married. And so there's no dating, there's no meeting with men. The way that these women get married in this community is that the parents arrange for them to sit with suitors, kind of like Pride and Prejudice, except it's happening right now. And that's how Daya is supposed to get married. She sits with a lineup of suitors, you know, every month she sits with a few men, and then she's supposed to agree to one of them. But she doesn't want to do that. She doesn't want to marry a stranger, because that's how her mother got married in her eyes. Her mother married a stranger and moved to America, and Daya doesn't want to be like her mother.
Well, I'm wondering, would you help us understand what the arguments for an arranged marriage rather than a marriage that's based on, you know, hot passion and romance and all of that? Sometimes don't they work out very nicely as people come to live with each other and have a family and come to respect each other? Can't you make an argument for arranged marriages?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You can definitely make an argument for arranged marriages, and you can make an argument for any type of marriage, really. But that wasn't the point of the story. My point was that there were limited options. So I think that's the point. Not whether or not one is better than the other. I mean, half of Americans are divorced, myself included. So it's not like hot and passionate gets you anywhere either. So that's not the point of my story. The point for Daya was she wanted the ability to make her own choices and have the agency over her own life, and not to be told what to do.
Well, let's. I love talking about the story, but I'm more and more curious about your life, and to a certain extent, I'm just guessing that that your novel has some autobiographical features in it. And so you mentioned that you're divorced. Was your marriage an arranged marriage, or was it a marriage of a boyfriend-girlfriend?
No, my marriage was an arranged marriage.
And then will you talk about how it worked out? Did you have some children, are they children of this marriage?
Yes. I got into a marriage when I was 19, and that is what actually brought me to North Carolina. He was born and raised in North Carolina, and so naturally, a 19-year-old girl with no money would, of course, move, like many people do, where the husband lives, because he was a primary breadwinner. And I got pregnant immediately after, and had my daughter and then a son. So I have a 9-year-old girl and a 7-year-old boy, and that's it. What was the question?
I love where you're going. It was the question was your marriage an arranged marriage, or was it one that developed sort of American?
It was arranged.
How did I suppose your parents persuade you to follow this Palestinian tradition or Arab tradition?
Those were my options. There were no other options. I mean, falling in love was not an option, because I couldn't fall in love because I was raised in a very sheltered house. And so I knew that eventually I would have to get married the way that my parents got married, and I would just have to choose a good man based on what my parents found for me, and that's what I did. And then,
well, I do want to talk about this some more, but let me catch my breath and let's take a quick break. If you join us late, I'm visiting with Itaf Rum. She's grew up in Brooklyn in the Palestinian immigrant community, but now lives in Rocky Mount and is a North Carolinian, and she's telling us about the clash of cultures, and we'll be right back. ¶¶ Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I've had a wonderful time talking to Itaf Rum. She is the author of a brand new book. It's her debut novel, A Woman Is No Man. We talked about the book, and we'll talk about the book some more. But even as interesting as the book is her life in Rocky Mount, growing up in Brooklyn in the Palestinian immigrant community, and then hitting the road in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. Tell us about your coming to Rocky Mount and your impressions of the of that town in eastern North Carolina when you got there. It wasn't Brooklyn.
Yeah, so it's definitely not Brooklyn. So Brooklyn is just a beautifully, in my opinion, growing up, you look down the street and you see immigrants of all kinds. You see Arabs, Chinese, Polish, Russian, Russian, Greek, everything. You see all, it's a melting pot. And when I first moved, again, I was young, but when I first moved to North Carolina, to Rocky Mount, it was just a very small southern town. Very unlike my experiences as a kid growing up in this diverse place. So yeah, that's really the impression that I had. I've grown to love North Carolina. I consider myself now, having been here, I think, 9 years, that now North Carolina is my favorite place. But it did take a long time to adjust.
When you came to North Carolina and Rocky Mount, it seems like you very quickly got involved in the North Carolina higher educational system. Mm-hmm. North Carolina State, and then teaching it to community colleges. How can a young woman out of a kind of closed-in Palestinian society, arranged marriage, come in and immediately burst out the door and start going to university?
Yeah, because I was super stubborn. I got married when I was 19. Luckily, my ex-husband was open-minded in terms of my education. He never stopped me. As long as I was taking care of my kids and, you know, fulfilling my domestic duties, he never told me that I wasn't allowed to go to college. And so I you know, overdosed on college.
How did you find, where did you, go to North Carolina State first?
Yeah.
And how did you, this young woman from Brooklyn in a small southern town, how did you get to North Carolina State? I mean, did you see an ad in the newspaper, or did you find somebody who was a good counselor? How did that work?
Oh, I mean, I was really smart, so I just applied. I actually got into UNC and State, but UNC was too far of a drive for me. It was an hour and a half drive from where I lived, and State was only a 50-minute drive. And so I went to State, and I drove twice a week, and I took all my classes either Monday, Wednesday, or Tuesday, Thursday. Every semester I would make my schedule where I wasn't far away from my kids. You know, I took a lot of summer classes. I took a lot of online classes. And eventually I was able to obtain two undergraduate degrees.
What kinds of courses did you take? And what were your aspirations when you began college?
So when I began college, I was pregnant, because I got pregnant right away. And growing up, I always wanted to be a lawyer. I thought, you know, I'm stubborn, I want to be a lawyer, I'd be really good at defending people, I wanted to study women's rights and just help people. And my ex was not really okay with that, because lawyers work long hours, and you can't be a mother and a lawyer. That's just not going to work. As great as he was in allowing me to pursue my education, of course there was this umbrella in which I could not, there was a ceiling for me that I could not break through, in terms of, well, yeah, you can pursue your education, but you still have to be a mother first. I don't want my children to be raised in daycares. I want them to be picked up from school by their mom. You know, all values that I respect. So I thought to myself, okay, I am getting my education, so let me be more realistic about my aspirations. And that's when I decided to study literature and teach. And that way I was able to pick up my kids from school.
But let me just ask you this. Were there some inspirational teachers at State that opened your life, or were you just a regular student?
Oh, no, there were so many inspirational teachers. Dr. John Murillo, who taught me British Lit, Romanticism. Dr. Ann Baker, who I studied Southern literature under, loved her. There's another doctor, John, and his name is escaping me, but he was also so amazing. There was many teachers. I wouldn't say I was a teacher's pet, but I was just hungry.
Well, did you fall in love with British literature at State, or did you bring that from Brooklyn, that love for that kind of literature?
Well, growing up, I loved reading. I mean, I read everything. But it was only when I got to State that I realized my first literature course at State was actually with Dr. Ann Baker, and it was a Southern literature class. And I forget what we were reading exactly, but that was when I decided, it was my first semester there, and that's when I decided, you know what, I can't be a lawyer, I'm going to study literature.
Well, all right, then, so you finished State. You did some graduate work, too, didn't you?
I had a master's in American and British Lit.
And then what did you do when you got back to Rocky Mount?
And then when I got back to Rocky Mount, I taught in a community college, Nash Community College, which is in my neighborhood.
Now, can you make a living in community college teaching?
Yeah, it's pretty good. I taught there for 5 years, and yeah, you make some good money.
And so what are your aspirations for the future in terms other than being a successful writer? I think this wonderful book that you've written is a good start, A Woman Is No Man.
I don't know. I feel like I've accomplished everything that I've wanted to accomplish, and which is beautiful to say, since I never thought that I ever would accomplish anything, but I have. And to be honest, like, my book went on sale yesterday, and I'm still on cloud nine. Like, I'm waiting to wake up, if that makes sense. So maybe you can ask me that after I really, really believe that this is happening, because I'm still in disbelief.
That is such a good answer. I love that. Well, one other thing. Have you taught at both community colleges down there, or just at Nash?
I was adjuncting at Edgecombe Community College while I was still at State. And then once I graduated, I started at Nash.
You got the
full-time faculty position. Yeah.
But you've left that now to write.
I don't teach anymore. I taught there for 5 years. And then once I started writing full-time and I sold my book, I couldn't do that. I couldn't be a writer and a teacher at the same time. So.
Well, we just got a minute before the break, but I read somewhere that you taught yoga, too.
Oh, yeah.
Tell them about that.
Yes, yeah. They needed a yoga instructor, and I did yoga, so I went and I got certified, and I started teaching yoga, and it was really fun. I taught it for about two, 3 years, and it was really fun.
If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Itaf Rum. She is the author of her debut novel, A Woman Is No Man. Wonderful book, and just a wonderful story that she brings. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Itaf Rum. She is the author of A Woman Is No Man. Now, for Chapel Hill people, there's just an interesting connection. If you did join us late, you may not know that our guest grew up in Brooklyn as part of the Palestinian family and community there. And that's the setting for her book in Brooklyn. And those of us who grew up in or who live in Chapel Hill, many of us know about Betty Smith. We have the Betty Smith House. Betty Smith grew up in Brooklyn, came to North Carolina, and wrote A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. So I think this is this just doesn't happen very often, and it's that part's a great story. I loved your book. But I have a problem, and it was difficult to construct because, as you mentioned earlier, you have sort of two timelines of the mother who dies and then her daughter, each about 20 years apart, trying to adjust. And the daughter is telling the story about her mother, and then at the end of the book, there is a conclusion about maybe what happened to the mother. Mm-hmm. Tell us that ending. I'm a literalist. That ending puzzled me. Will you tell us a little bit about the ending without giving it away? A little bit about it and how you got there.
Yeah, I suspect that the ending so far, from like reviews and hearing people talk about the ending is going to be, it's either you love it or you hate it type of ending.
Tell us about those who love it and why they love it.
All right. So the story follows Ezra, right? And Ezra and Adam. And we know that Ezra and Adam are dead.
If you joined us late, Ezra is the Palestinian girl who's in an arranged marriage with an American who comes and dies.
Dea is their daughter, and the timeline alternates between Dea, the daughter, Ezra's daughter, who's in search of an identity and in search of her own path, and then Ezra, the mother, who died and left Dea to be raised by her grandparents. So we know that Dea and Adam, Dea's parents, are dead. Towards the end of the story, we are like just desperate to find out how Ezra and Adam died. How did they die? And that's the mystery that kind of pulls the story, mm-hmm. because Dea is growing up to believe that her parents died in a car crash, but that's not the whole truth. And so as we get to the end of the story, Dea is also learning more about herself and her ability to go beyond the path that her mother and father and grandparents created for her. She wants to be a storyteller. She wants to tell stories, write, and that's how she understands herself. And she's the one telling us this story, mm-hmm. Dea. Dea is telling us this story. So when we leave off with Dea, I never go fully into exactly how, as in detail by detail, how the parents die, because we know as readers, through the plot unfolding, we know how they die. So I felt like putting that scene in there was just adding more despair to an already sorrowful story. Mm. And I wanted to...
You made us cry twice.
I wanted to end it on a moment of hope. And so Dea, imagining based on her memories, so she knows the night her parents died, she remembers it, but now after finally realizing the truth and hearing she now replays this scene again in her mind of her mother dying, but in a completely different narrative. So she rewrites the narrative of her mother's death, and she gives it meaning, a meaning that will help her, Dea, carry on her life with bravery and courage.
Well, okay, I understand it better. I like it. Now, I want to return. We've just got a couple of minutes left, and I'm fascinated with your life and your growing up and the estrangement that often apparently happens when a ambitious woman breaks away from the tradition. How about you? Can you go back to Brooklyn? Are your family still wide open, or has your breaking away strained your family relationships?
It has definitely strained my family relationships. Yeah, it has. More of a combination of things, I think. My parents were not approving of me getting a divorce. They were not approving of the decisions I decided to take after the divorce. And I'm sure a lot of people in my community will not approve of my decision to tell this story as authentically as I chose to tell it, in fear of stereotyping the community or further reinforcing this single story of oppression and patriarchy. But so yes, needless to say that me breaking away in my personal life and deciding to stand up for these women in my fiction, in my story, has come at a cost, and that cost is being outcasted from my family.
A real outcast. So you can't go back for holidays or to take your children to Brooklyn to visit their grandparents?
No. And my mom and my dad actually don't live in Brooklyn anymore, but my grandparents still live in Brooklyn. My uncles, my aunts, they live in Brooklyn. My parents live in Florida now. But no, we don't. There's just the divide right now.
Well, so it's painful, and I don't want to push it at all, but you've got courage, and you seem absolutely happy with your life. How do you balance that? I mean, how do you get along without the family connections? I mean, you've had to really make a big sacrifice to achieve your ambition.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wouldn't say, so yesterday was my very first event. The book went on sale, my very first event at Quail Ridge, and it was kind of sad to actually be there. It was a great turnout. Almost 100 people showed up, but not one person in the crowd was my family. Mm. And so it is really sad. So I don't know if I would say that I'm happy. Do I feel more, do I feel like I'm living a more authentic life? Yes, absolutely. And I think to me that that's more important than being happy.
Well, I mean, you're not alone in our culture. Women often, and men too, when they follow their dreams or follow what they think is a calling from God or some other, and their family doesn't agree with them, sometimes these things require a family breakup. So that doesn't keep it from being sad. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you for
a wonderful conversation. and congratulations on your new book, this is a success, and you know that you've always got a place in Chapel Hill because you and Betty Smith, these are the Brooklyn girls who come and made North Carolina famous. We thank you for that.
What an honor. Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure.
Thanks to Etap Rum for sharing her book, A Woman Is No Man, with us. And thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, and I'll be back here before you know it.